This is Layla Mudin, RD. I see patients every day here at the Hoffman Center. If you require a nutrition consult with me, but live out of town, there's no need to travel to New York City. I have telephone consultations with clients from all over the country. Please visit drhoffman.com for more information. And to set up an appointment, call 212-779-1744. That's 212-779-1744. I look forward to being a collaborator in your healthcare.
Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, today talking with Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mudin, answering your questions. You can email us your questions to radioprogram@aol.com. And I also want to express appreciation for your support of our sponsors and your support of these podcasts by doing your supplement shopping at drhoffman.com. We have many of the supplements, some of the even esoteric supplements that we talk about on these podcasts are available at drhoffman.com. Click on the store and it'll direct you to a full inventory of our products. So what's our next question, Layla?
Okay, we've got a question from Tom. Dear Dr. Hoffman and Layla, what is your opinion on a man over 50 taking these testosterone supplements on the market now? It seems like there are so many, and they make it sound like any man over 50 or between 50 and 60 needs to be taking these. What are the side effects? I've heard that it may increase your chances of prostate cancer. Are there ways to increase testosterone naturally?
Well, let's...
I think there's an epidemic of low testosterone.
Right. There's a variety of ways to discuss. Let's start with that.
Yeah. I think there's an epidemic of low testosterone. In America, at least. I think it has mostly to do with overweight and obesity, metabolic syndrome, all of that, belly fat, aromatizing any testosterone, habits, you know.
Too much alcohol. Lack of sleep.
Lack of sleep deprivation. Sedentary life.
It's also the biology of defeat, and many men are downtrodden and defeated. They are. Mm-hmm. And the result is it's the biology of defeat. The psychology of defeat is depression. But the biology of defeat is that your sex hormones decline.
Yeah.
They do tend to decline. So all these lifestyle factors militate towards low testosterone. However, it's very variable. You know, like women generally, you know, between 45 and 55, 98% of women are going to go through menopause.
Yeah.
With men, andropause, very variable, because some men get symptoms of andropause in their 30s.
Huh.
Some men who are in their 70s and 80s are very vibrant, father children, and, you know, are lean and mean and have adequate levels of testosterone. And I see this in my practice when I check men for testosterone levels.
Yeah.
So it is not, there's inevitable a bit of a decline as you age, but it kind of depends on the conditioning, whether you have a lot of body fat, whether you're getting adequate sleep. Another thing that might deplete testosterone, frankly, is a vegan diet.
Yeah.
You know, because the steroid hormones are based on dietary cholesterol, and if you really are in cholesterol deprivation, you know, you have to rely on your own body produced cholesterol.
Yeah.
You don't get outside help. So, well, look, there's plenty of vegans very fine, doing well, potent, but it is a risk factor. Nutritional deficiency, over-exercise can kind of kill your testosterone too. Excess exercise, just as in women sometimes lose their periods with too much exercise.
But I think it's more under-exercise for most people.
The vast majority,
yeah.
But, you know, like, say, really, really high mileage endurance sports, you know, like ultra-marathons or something like that, that could possibly damage your testosterone.
That could damage your immune system too, possibly.
Sure. So coming back to what should men be taking these?
Yeah.
Well, first of all, I don't believe in these products. The vast majority of these products don't do anything. There's not a lot of science behind them. And in fact, there's some dangers, because recently it was disclosed, I mean, it's been a long story, but that there are products on the market that actually have, they have testosterone or testosterone-like or steroid-like substances that's illegal. It's, you know, it's you know, not allowed. Some of these products come from China. Some of them are, very fly-by-night companies. Some contain not natural Viagra, but Viagra. They actually contain Viagra and Cialis and, you know, traces of these medications, so that you feel kind of a little bit of a boost in the bedroom department, but that's because there's actually medication in them. So, you know, some natural things that help. Maybe maca is a little bit stimulating. But is there really a danger that you're going to get prostate cancer from these things? Well, that would be if they worked. They don't really work. So it's I don't think they're dangerous. And in fact, let's look at testosterone itself. Testosterone should be given under a doctor's supervision. You need to carefully monitor a man's PSA and make sure they don't have prostate cancer to begin with. But for the most part, it's been proven very safe from the standpoint. Testosterone itself has been proven very safe. So not there's two removals from risk. One is that these medications don't increase your testosterone. It's mostly a placebo effect. And B, even if they did, it probably wouldn't be so bad or dangerous. You know, I think men who've experienced symptoms of reduced libido, lethargy, lack of motivation, if you have type 2 diabetes, these are men who really should be evaluated for low testosterone. Or, you know, have a real loss of muscle tone or what we call sarcopenia, which is the opposite of obesity, but very skinny, fragile men, maybe men who've been found to have osteoporosis, early osteoporosis. These are things that would call into possible question the need for testosterone. And then the other one, over-the-counter supplement that actually is helpful, but it may or may not increase testosterone, but you should need to be careful with it, is DHEA.
Yes, the precursor, the substrate.
It's not really quite, you know, I've noticed that in men taking DHEA, it's variable. Some of the DHEA goes towards testosterone, some of it goes towards, unfortunately, towards estrogen. So
I think that also has to do with the state of health of the person taking it. If they've got a lot of excess weight or something, those fat cells could be aromatizing. But ways to naturally increase your testosterone, Tom, lose any excess weight, number one. Stop drinking. Maybe you'll do the whole 30 like Dr. Hoffman. Did you know that if you're a marijuana user, now that it's being legalized, more people are rational. Oh, well, why don't I just go ahead? Guess what? That can plummet your testosterone if you're going to use it regularly.
Men often develop gynecomastia, chronic pot smokers.
You might keep all the hair on your head or something, but your other things will happen. Exercise, particularly strength training, could be very beneficial.
More strength training. More strength training.
For boosting testosterone.
It's been shown that after a bout of strength training, you increase your levels of growth hormone and testosterone. That's
double whammy, a wonderful double whammy. So these are things, and getting enough sleep.
And
all of that.
You know, and
eating well.
And psychologically getting into a better space. Because there are even some studies that look at, you know, during the Super Bowl, as one side wins, one side loses, they actually looked at the saliva testosterone of the winning and losing fans, not for the team members. Because the team members obviously are devastated and deflated when they lose, but the fans. They found that it was a pronounced decline in the testosterone of the losing fans. You know, at the end of a Super Bowl.
That's fascinating.
As opposed to the male fans, that is, at the end of the Super Bowl. So, you know, that's why, I don't know, I just hope that you're on the winning side. Make sure you're on the winning side.
Make sure you're on the winning side, Tom. Thank you very, very much for your question. Here's another, this is a great question. Dear Dr. Hoffman, does the ketogenic diet cause ketoacidosis? No, is the short answer. There is a great misconception.
And I've seen scientific articles which can make your eyes cross on this. Very complicated explanations, because ketoacidosis and ketosis sound alike, but go ahead.
They're two completely different things. Ketoacidosis can be fatal because ketoacidosis is the accumulation of too many ketone bodies in the body from out of control blood sugars, from chronic alcoholism, from other kind of disease states, or even maybe certain medications. But being in ketosis simply means you're in a fat burning metabolism, which is actually called lipolysis slash ketosis. Ketone bodies are the byproducts of your fat burning, and they never go above a certain level. But on the other hand, an out-of-control diabetic with very high blood sugars, which would be, you know, they can create a state of ketoacidosis, which is completely different from what we're talking about.
I think one of the ways to look at it is the key difference is that in ketoacidosis, it's kind of like water, water everywhere, but not a drop to drink for the cells. There's tons of sugar. There's tons of sugar available. It can't get into the cells because of lack of insulin or the lack of efficacy of the little insulin that's left. In a normal state, you may be restricting your carbohydrates.
Yeah.
And as a result, your body goes into a fat-burning mode, which generates ketones, which isn't actually bad because it's a steady source of energy for the brain and the heart, and it even has been shown to be helpful for athletic performance.
Yeah. And, you know, I have to bring this up because I often think that it's our primary fuel. We are sitting here, we are both in a fat-burning state because we're sitting across from each other talking. If you're sprinting for the train or the bus, you're using your glycogen, you're burning more blood sugar than anything, than fat, to be able to do, to be able to run away from the predator, to be able to sprint towards the subway station, to be in a hurry. So our primary fuel is fat burning, and fat, being in a fat-burning metabolism also generates so much more ATP.
Right.
That's our energy currency,
right,
than being in a blood sugar burning state, that I have to wonder. And, you know, our prehistoric ancestors were in a fat burning state at least through the dead of winter, maybe 6 or 7 months.
Right, because there wasn't a lot of carbohydrate.
No.
They could sometimes find animals to kill, but the animals would be protein and fat.
Right.
And
no,
very little in the way of carbohydrate.
Exactly.
So carbohydrate has developed into a fuel that humans could utilize, but it's sort of like a secondary fuel, an inferior fuel, when you need the extra calories, and there's just not enough game or...
Mother Nature has set it up so that when there are enough carbohydrates around, produce, foliage, fruit, all of that, that our body will take those carbohydrates and tend to store them
Fat. And store them as fat.
Store them as fat for the next upcoming famine.
Right.
So, and the storage of glycogen, which is beneficial for your workout, for your energy, for your athleticism, your storage of glycogen is actually phase one of the beginning of your fat storage mechanism. That's really another way to look
at it.
That's
a very good explanation.
So, I really have to beg to differ, saying, well, we use blood sugar first, we need to keep the carbs up because that's our first form of fuel. I don't believe that it is.
And,
not
you know,
the
in the first simplistic criticisms of Atkins, and you were at Atkins in his heyday. You were a nutritionist at the Atkins Center before he passed away. Because conventional doctors are so imbued with this idea of ketoacidosis that they confused ketoacidosis with ketosis, and they would say, you don't, you know, Atkins would say, you want to be in ketosis.
Yeah.
And they say, what are you, crazy? Ketoacidosis is like, we see patients dying in the hospital of ketoacidosis, but they're different.
Mm-hmm.
They're different.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, it comes from
it's the acidosis part that's fatal.
Yeah.
Ketosis is a completely different.
You know, we as doctors, we are taught biochemistry, but it all goes by in a blur during medical school, and we tend to forget what we learned. We passed exams, we got our proficiency, and, you know, then you're out in the field practicing, and basically you practice by rote, like this drug for that condition, and you forget the underlying biochemistry, except where they're trying to sometimes sell you a drug and they'll show you a fancy diagram of how that drug works, and you kind of go, that sort of looks like what I studied in medical school, that looks legit, but we're not really utilizing our biochemical knowledge and thinking these things through.
Right, right. You know, a PhD biochemist will explain all day long the differences between
But the PhD biochemist isn't sitting there with a prescription pad in front of you, right, and when you go to the doctor.
Right.
He has the profound understanding, but the doctor may only have a superficial understanding.
There is no danger to being in ketosis for long periods of time. There really isn't. It's nice to come out of it as the seasons are changing, maybe get some fat stores back on, maybe get a little carbohydrate back, or even to stoke your metabolism so it continues being somewhat efficient or are borderline inefficient. Some people find that on a low-carb diet, if they've been doing it for a very long time, they will plateau for various reasons. But if they eat a little carbohydrate for a couple of days, it can restoke or reprime their metabolisms to bring them back.
That's interesting.
So it's like the 5-2 diet a little bit.
Okay.
A little bit of that principle.
There is five days.
The 5 days and then the 2 days off to kind of restoke. Or the 5-2 is more for people who just can't do it for seven whole days.
Okay.
Yeah.
Popular in England. It's the, what's the name of the guy?
Duquesne
diet. Yeah.
Well, he's got a day where you just eat nothing but meat. Wow.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
You could. It'll get boring. But
one way to cure you of your meat craving, I'll tell you.
Yeah. Oh, gosh.
We have time for, I guess, one more question.
Yeah. We have time for one more question. This comes from Cheryl. Dear Dr. Hoffman, I've been taking fish oil for years, but after hearing you talk about the importance of it so much, I'm afraid I'm not taking the correct one. I take a fish oil concentrate, 1,000 milligrams twice a day. It has EPA DHA 500 and other omega-3s of 100. Is this okay? I'm a leukemia survivor. I'm 64 years old, and I've had a bone marrow transplant in 09.
Okay. Well, let's just say one of the concerns for leukemia survivors, A, avoiding recurrence of leukemia, but B, because of all the intensive treatment, leukemia survivors are at risk for secondary malignancies.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, they've gotten so much treatment that it may cause their cells to mutate, and usually a cell mutation may take 20 or 30 years to manifest as a cancer.
Mm-hmm.
But many cancer survivors will, even if they don't get a recurrence of their original cancer, they're at higher risk for other cancers. So fish oil, being an anti-cancer supplement, is advisable, certainly. So the question is what to take. I mean, I believe in taking a really strong EPA-DHA combo with about, I would say, a 3-2 ratio of EPA to DHA. I really like DHA.
Yeah.
Certain applications, I might want more DHA where the brain is an issue more.
Like in DHA Select.
DHA Select, which emphasizes the DHA over the EPA. You can't usually get, well, you can get pure DHA, but, you know, that's not usually necessary. And do you recall how much is in the Orthomega that we know?
I think it's 1,000. I believe it's 1,000 to
1,200. It's 1,200 now.
Okay.
But I think it's a pretty high 600-700 of EPA plus DHA.
Yes.
In about a 3-2 ratio of EPA to DHA.
Mm-hmm.
So what are you looking at for a supplement? Well, you're not looking for the bargain basement supplement, because surely you can find something that is really cheap. But then, you know, A, it smells fishy because it's not really molecularly distilled.
It could be rancid, too.
It could be
rancid. It smells fishy. That's my greatest concern.
It could
that will cause inflammation in your body.
It could have more contaminants.
Yeah.
And usually you've got to look at not the physical size of the pill, because the physical size of the pill may be 1,000. You want to look at the percentage thereof. That is EPA DHA. It should be at least 60% or 70% of the EPA DHA alone, with all the other stuff that is.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't find an EPA DHA that is pure EPA and DHA 100%. You know, adds up to 100%.
Right.
But I think you can get it to like 70%.
Yeah.
And there's like, by the way, Nordic Naturals, one of our great sponsors. They have a whole range of EPA DHA supplements, very high quality, very high potency. I think they have a new one that's really good, and I'll be talking more about that. One of our sponsors, so, you know, support us by supporting our sponsors, or support us directly by going to drhoffman.com and shopping at our store.
And Cheryl, don't forget to eat your wild Alaskan salmon.
Yep.
And sardines, and maybe some baby mackerel, and dark green leafies have some amount of omega-3, not the same as taking a supplement, but eat well too.
And flax oil?
Flax oil, not so much. Because it's a plant-based, it's not going to convert as well.
It's got ALA.
ALA.
Alpha-linolenic acid.
Exactly. And it does not convert well in, I think, 70% of humans.
We can do a test where we can actually assess a person's ability. It's a useful test in vegetarians sometimes to see if they're converting. But it's a genetic thing. It's also sicker people on certain medications, they have more difficulty converting.
That's true.
And certain vitamin deficiencies predisposed to inefficient conversion of the precursor.
You need certain vitamins, you need certain micronutrients to make sure that desaturase pathway is working the way that it should.
I think B6 absolutely. Is involved, I think magnesium
B6,
is involved.
Magnesium, absolutely.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. So those are some of the considerations when it comes. Did we answer her question pretty much?
Yeah.
Because she had a lot of aspects to her question.
No, she wanted to make sure she's taking enough.
Well, the other question is, how much to take?
How much to take, being a leukemia survivor who's had a bone marrow transplant.
Right. Look, it depends, because there's certain reasons to take a lot of fish oil. So, for example, people with high triglycerides, do you know that the one approved medical indication prescribed omega-3s is for high triglycerides? Mm. If you take about 6 a day, you will significantly lower your triglycerides even without changing your diet.
Even while eating pizza and French fries?
Yes. It will somewhat mitigate the effect of
that.
But really what you want to do is you want to eat less carbs.
Stop eating pizza and French fries.
But even fruit juice or fructose can do that.
Of course.
Soda could raise your,
Yeah.
We have people in,
people having smoothies every day in the summer,
I take a little issue with what you say, because you make it seem like you have to be eating junk food to have high triglycerides. You could be eating a really natural foods diet lots of whole grains and whole grain bread and plenty of fruit and some fruit juice and have a sky-high triglyceride.
That's true.
Even though everything comes from whole foods or, from wild by nature.
Right, right.
You could still stoke your carbohydrate.
A high-carb diet, and it doesn't have to be refined carbohydrates.
Right. So that's one reason to take fish oil. Another reason to take fish oil at high doses is for depression.
Mm.
High doses have been shown to be helpful for depression, bipolar disorder, to some extent anxiety. Also for autoimmune diseases. We have studies that show that 9 fish oil capsules daily for ulcerative colitis. Or inflammatory bowel disease.
Yes,
we have it for rheumatoid arthritis. We have it for lupus. We have it for
cardiovascular disease.
MS, things like that.
Yeah.
That the inflammatory disorders, perhaps even psoriasis, high dose, really high dose. We really want to push those high doses. So that I've been successful with many autoimmune conditions by pushing the high doses. We had a woman with a peculiar lupus-like, very, very painful syndrome that is doing really wonderful on many supplements, but among them high-dose fish oil.
And a Paleolithic diet.
And a Paleo diet, which she
sticks to.
And
nightshade-free.
Right, nightshade.
Yeah, she's doing very well.
So those are some of the considerations when you are taking fish oil. And another way to improve your omega-3s is to have less omega-6s, like we talked about in part one. There's so many sources of, you look at your mayonnaise, you look at your condiments,
grains,
your salad dressings.
Your poultry.
Paul Newman's salad dressing with olive oil has soybean oil in it.
Right.
It's not pure olive oil.
Exactly.
You just make your dressing
at
home.
That would get expensive, yes.
Right. Yeah. It would be too expensive, and it would also not have good shelf life.
That's true.
Because, it's not going to sit in a supermarket for months and months.
Right.
So you have to have these more stable oils, which are rich in omega-6. So it's not just the amount of omega-3s you take in, it's the ratio.
Yes.
And if you can reduce your omega-6s by eating also grass-fed beef that has a higher omega-6 content.
Omega-3 content, yeah.
I'm sorry, omega-3 content.
Yeah. We want that ratio of omega-6 to 3 to be more like 2 to 1, not more than 4 to 1. And the standard American diet,
it's like 11 to 1. 20 to 1,
20 to 1.
Right.
Pizza and French fries diet is 50 to 1.
Right. Absolutely. Well, no more French fries for me this month, that's for sure. All right, so that pretty much covers it for today's edition of the Intelligent Medicine Podcast, our weekly Q&A with Layla. We invite you to send your questions to radioprogram@aol.com. And we had some great questions today. We invite you to pose your questions. So these questions are right on target, grist for the mill for some great conversation about health and nutrition. And I want to thank our listeners for your faithful listenership. And once again, a very happy new year as we proceed into 2016. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.